This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. President Trump this week continued his pattern of making some bold proposals and then drawing them back a bit. The issue this time, tariffs on steel and aluminum. The president signed the orders for the tariffs yesterday, saying that he was going to save the U.S. steel industry from other countries, especially China, that flood the American market with cheap products.
It's a process called dumping. And they dumped more than at any time on any nation, anywhere in the world. And it drove our plants out of business. It drove our factories out of business. And we want a lot of steel coming into our country, but we want it to be fair.
But Sam Blatchford from the New England-based American Steel and Aluminum Company says that just the talk of tariffs sent his prices higher.
We've seen a dramatic increase in prices between anywhere from, 25 to 40%, depending on the product category. It's more about availability, making sure that we do have an ample supply, and it's difficult to get the material into New England to begin with.
And Rick Maher of Woburn's Lord Hobo Brewing Company says those increases in prices could harm his company's growth.
This would hit us deep into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. Any artificial increase to input costs to our business is pretty painful. So increasing those input costs by 10 or 25% is a drag and, money that otherwise could be invested in our growth.
So will these new tariffs help protect American businesses or increase costs all the way around? That's just one of the topics we're going to take up with our Week in Review panel today. With us in studio, Jennifer Braceras, conservative political analyst and a senior fellow at the Independent Women's Forum, also former editor-in-chief of NewBostonPost.com. Jennifer, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Also with us, Michael Jonas, executive editor of Commonwealth Magazine. Thanks for coming in as well, Michael.
Good to be here.
Okay, so let's start with the president and tariffs, and started out saying blanket tariffs, but then there was all kinds of chaos in Washington over what this proposal might mean. So when he did sign the order yesterday about the tariffs, the president did exempt Canada and Mexico from the tariffs in the hopes of renegotiating NAFTA more favorably for the U.S. What's your reaction, A, to the tariffs, Michael, and B, to this strategy?
The reaction to the tariffs, I think it's kind of a classic, in some ways, classic Trump move in two ways. One is that it is actually one of the few things that he's had a consistent view on for decades and that he's actually sort of following through on. People are kind of shocked about that because he's been generally pretty erratic in his views. On the other hand, it's also kind of classic Trump in that he's kind of approached it with a kind of ready, fire, aim, trajectory in which they seem to be kind of making things up as they're going along. Even at the ceremony yesterday, there was talk online that it wasn't clear if they actually had a formal agreement he was signing or was this a placeholder while they were still working out the details. So it was kind of classic kind of, Trump White House chaos that seemed to be unfolding. Mm-hmm. And I think, as for the tariffs themselves, I kind of side with the 90% of economists who don't see this as a particularly wise move. It's not going to, overnight revive the steel and aluminum industry here. I don't think it's going to be disastrous either. I mean, I think the bigger issue or concern is sort of the signal it may send about what could be coming down the road in terms of, is this the approach this administration is going to take to what is really an increasingly globalized economy? Mm-hmm. That's, I think, where the shockwaves are kind of coming. If it's steel and aluminum today, I mean, are we going to sort of set up a way to sort of revive our textile and garment industry in the U.S. or, you just don't really know what's next.
Right. And what does it mean about Gary Cohn and all that? We'll get to that in a second. But I'm also wondering, Jennifer, what do you think about this and about the fact that key Republicans were opposed to this?
Well, conservatives have long been in favor of free trade, and this is a position that doesn't comport with most conservative ideology. Most Republicans are against it. In fact, the people who favor it most are Rust Belt Democrats. But as Michael said, this is one of a few positions that President Trump has been consistent on. He campaigned on it. He campaigned hard on it, and he arguably won the election because of it in those key Rust Belt swing states.
Right. And we did hear, the big concern really is international reaction to this, how other countries are going to react. And we heard from the European Union. European Union officials said that they would raise import duties on a number of U.S. products, including bourbon, peanut butter, motorcycles. So some folks are saying, okay, bourbon,
Not bourbon.
Kentucky.
Yeah. I don't know.
Mitch McConnell.
Right.
Harley Davidson, motorcycle, Wisconsin, Paul Ryan. But, you know, is this political on the part of international folks saying we're going to target?
Of course it is. Okay. Because when George Bush actually did this during his presidency, George W. Bush, and ended up repealing them after folks in the European Union said that they were going to specifically target Florida and other swing states for his upcoming election. They were going to target products that went into those states so that the quality of life for those people might take a turn for the worse and he would lose those votes. I mean, that was, you know, people play politics on both sides of the ocean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just was wondering if that was someone's conspiracy theory or if you actually thought that it was legitimate here.
I think it's absolutely legitimate. I mean, those things happen.
So let's talk about Gary Cohn, as we mentioned, that we were going to talk about. The president's former now chief economic advisor. He stepped aside this week. Many said it was because he doesn't agree with this whole tariff notion. And he was really the free trade person in the president's cabinet. And the president said this about Cohn this week.
He's been terrific. He may be a globalist, but I still like him. He is seriously a globalist, there's no question. But you know what? In his own way, he's a nationalist because he loves our country.
Now, there's all kinds of debate about what that use of the term globalist might mean. Is it a dog whistle to the alt-right here or a pejorative comment? What do you make of the president describing Gary Cohn as a globalist here? Michael?
I guess I would sort of give him the benefit of the doubt and just call it, you know, take it at face value that, you know, he's clearly part of the wing of the administration that has not embraced the Trump views on protectionism. And he was the free trader. And there were, frankly, a lot of them in there. I mean, you know, the irony of Trump railing against Wall Street is that he brought in all these, you know, Wall Street guys and Goldman Sachs people. And Cohn was certainly part of that. So, you know, I mean, the funnier thing is that, you know, when he talks about, you know, I like him and he likes me. I mean, with Trump, everything is a matter of, you know, who's liked and who's liking whom. And he's a globalist, but I like him. It gets divorced from the policy. But it does signal, again, the sort of continuing exit of those folks from the White House, which is troubling, I think, to mainstream Republicans and potentially to the markets
point. And that was what you had mentioned that you think is really the bigger issue here. Bigger than the tariffs is the fact that what's gone on around this and what that might mean for future economic policy. So what do you mean by that?
I mean, I just think that this is really the first major move by the president to make good on that protectionist view that he propounded on the campaign trail. And so if it signals sort of a turn and that this is the first of what are going to be many steps, then I think that is potentially much more troubling, to the country, to Republican base, than if it's just sort of a one-off. And again, you know, if he turns next week and it's, you know, he could swing in the other direction or go with something else. So I think that's the thing that we don't really know, whether he's actually going to say, you know, this is the thing I campaigned on, as Jennifer said, I'm going to really make good on it. And this is, you know, step one, and there's five more coming.
Hmm. I think it has some interesting implications for international relations and international law generally, because the WTO doesn't have to approve this. And then, of course, if they don't approve it, Donald Trump and this administration can say, who cares, right? And so up until this point, the World Trade Organization has operated successfully because the participants abide by their rulings. They choose to abide by their rulings. But if this president decides, I don't have to abide by their rulings, and he doesn't legally, then there's no reason for any other country to abide by their rulings. And the whole sort of international order collapses as a house of cards. So it has much broader implications than just steel.
Right. And do you think that these will have these tariffs will have a damaging effect on the economy?
My sense is they will. I'm not an economist, but I agree, like Michael said, with the majority of economists who think that it will. It may be a small effect. I think politically, Donald Trump wins at home with this, because even just showing that he's trying to do something engenders so much loyalty to him from people in those key Rust Belt states. And if the impact is small, whether it's, you know, small in a positive way or small in a negative way, they still feel like he's fighting for them, mm-hmm. which was you know, that was his calling card, and that's why they love him.
Right, right. Well, let's talk about some things that are a little bit closer to home, the recent nor'easters, and now the talk of global climate change because of them. Now, as of airtime, there were still some 160,000 Massachusetts customers without power, mostly in the Merrimack Valley. We had two storms with strong winds, heavy rains. We saw astronomical high tides in the past week. And twice this winter, Massachusetts has been hit by a so-called 100-year storm. And I do want to say weather is not climate, but the frequency and the severity of these storms have many people wondering if we are ready for the effects of climate change in Massachusetts. Governor Charlie Baker over the weekend surveyed coastal damage, and this is what he said.
A lot of the coastal stuff is probably going to be part of our future, and we need to come up with some plans for that.
And on Wednesday, during the storm, WBUR spoke with Karen Keneally in Scituate, and she said she's worried about long-term effects.
You know, they keep saying, oh, this is a once-in-a-100-year storm, and we've had how many of them in the past 12 months? So I feel that sometime it's going to be time to reevaluate. Mm-hmm.
So the question is, are officials doing enough to prepare here, and can they? Michael, your thoughts.
I mean, I think there is a fair amount that has been going on, both in the city, or particularly in the city of Boston. I don't think that we're nearly ready if it's going to be, things are going to be coming at the pace of these two storms. So I think, you know, it's kind of a yes and no answer. It's certainly on their radar, and there are steps being taken. Some things, though, feel a little, you know, we're talking about building codes or in the seaport, you know, places where they're putting infrastructure on upper floors. It's a little bit of admitting defeat when they're sort of assuming that there is going to be a good chance of water flooding into those areas. It's still better than nothing.
Well, I think you have to assume that. I mean, when you build essentially on the water, eventually the ocean is going to come back and attempt to reclaim what was taken from it, whether that's in the Back Bay or at the seaport. And I think the question is, you know, you have to have a strategy for developing those areas to begin with. How much is too much is not the wrong question. But if you're going to develop there, the questions that people have to ask are, how can we be prepared? And I think from a political standpoint and even a marketing standpoint, people have spent inordinate amounts of energy on going green and trying to prevent climate change, when in fact, the real emphasis should be on being prepared for it and climate resiliency. It's sort of like a person who's aging and they're desperately trying to stop the aging process with all sorts of plastic surgery instead of figuring out how can they live their life under this new set of circumstances, which in some sense is inevitable. I mean, we can do things to limit the effects of climate change, but we're not going to turn back the clock.
You know, we did a show about this earlier this week, as we said, and we heard from a caller who said he was Joe in Dorchester, and he said he was frustrated with dealing with extreme weather that seems to keep coming and feeling as if officials aren't doing enough. Let's listen to what he said.
The seaport is going to be underwater in 25 years, and they won't stop building there, and it floods all the time. I'm in Dorchester right now in gridlock traffic on Dorchester Ave. Because Morrissey Boulevard is flooding. So what is the government of this state doing about it? Because I've had it.
And, of course, we did talk with someone in government, Boston's Chief of Environment, Energy, and Open Space, Austin Blackman. He spoke with us during the show, and he said that there are concrete things that the city's already accomplished.
We've come up with shovel-ready projects, and we've actually announced that we're going to be moving forward with implementation on $2 million worth of them as well, both to protect an area of Charlestown close to the Sullivan Square, and then also in East Boston on the East Boston Greenway, which is one of the very first flood entry pathways that allows water not only to go through the Greenway, but then actually shuttle past several other neighborhoods of East Boston as well.
Now, Michael, Jennifer brought up an interesting question. How much is too much or how much is enough, right? Isn't that the question here? So do you think that the city has made significant strides toward trying to prepare the state? Governor Baker says he plans to file legislation as early as next week. What more could be done, do you think?
I think they're making strides. I don't think they've done enough. I mean, we clearly have seen that we're not really prepared for these kind of events if they're going to happen with this kind of regularity. But I think that we may need to start thinking a little more outside the box. I mean, just for one example, we had a piece submitted at Commonwealth Magazine by three architects 2 months ago that we ran on our website, in which they proposed a 14-mile dike that would run out in Boston Harbor all the way from Swampscott down to Cohasset. And to be honest, we kind of hesitated before we posted it, wondering if this was, frankly, a bit of a crackpot idea. The price tag, I'll tell you, is in the billions, and it's, you know, somewhere between, I think, $30 and $50 billion. But I'm seeing more talk about things like that, that are ways that, you know, you're not going to prevent the change. But there's some logic to this idea of trying to mitigate the rush of the tides. And they pointed to sort of some natural benefits we have of these highlands, both at on the North Shore and the South Shore, that would be kind of the bookends for that. So again, 2 months ago, I hadn't really read about it. I thought it seemed a little out there. I'm not so sure now that they might not be onto something. And it may take something bigger than that. I'm not sure that, you know, what we're going to hear from the governor or some of the steps the city is taking are, you know, probably looks sort of more like small ball compared to what might need to happen.
Right. Do you think, Jennifer, that we'll see something big from the governor after this suggestion that he's going to do something next week, but we're not exactly sure what, possibly another study, but we don't know?
Yeah, I'm not sure. What I've heard him say before is that we need a coast-to-coast study and that the solutions for one community might not be the same as the solutions for another community, which I think are right. And this is a problem that, you know, the developers are going to have to tackle, the engineers are going to have to tackle. But government's going to have to tackle it as well, both with studies and possibly new regulations on the way in which we develop. You know, as a conservative, I'm not generally for a lot of regulation, but this is an area where I think it's really necessary because it's the one thing that all people really want from their government is to keep them safe, whether from terrorism or natural disaster. And so in an area like this, I think it's incumbent upon government to regulate for the greater good. So, you know, I think it's going to have to be a multifaceted approach. Families and individual communities are going to have to look at the structures that they live in and figure out how to shore them up as well and how to tend to the vulnerable within their communities in the case of natural disasters. There have to be community plans and family plans in place.
Okay, I want to just make sure we can talk about politics before I let you go here. This week, former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick was on KCUR radio in Kansas City, and he was asked if he was thinking about a presidential run.
It's on my radar screen, but, you know, it's a huge decision. It's a huge consideration, I think, particularly when I think, you know, I'm still a kid from the south side of Chicago, and I am trying to think through 2020, and that's a decision I'm trying to think through from a personal and family point of view, and also whether, you know, what I believe is going to be on offer by somebody.
So, Michael Jonas, when you hear that response from former Governor Patrick, what do you think? Is he going to run?
Put me down as a little bit of a skeptic. I'm just not convinced that that's really what's in his future. I mean, I think most people around here remember the grave reservations that his wife had about him entering into public life. And I'm also just, I'm not sure that, I don't know, that he's going to be sort of what the doctor ordered when the race comes along. I mean, his message here was, you know, very sort of aspirational and thematic is what he offered voters. You know, now perhaps if people are looking for somebody, you know, after this sort of divisive time that sort of gives that message of unity and bringing people together, that maybe that'll have some appeal. But I'm not yet convinced that it's going to be a Patrick moment.
Mm. Jennifer, what do you think? Should he run?
Well, I don't know. I mean, not if the Democrats want to win. I think it's interesting because they clearly didn't get the memo. You know, they clearly didn't get the feeling of the country in November, you know, 2016, right? And so instead, they keep talking about all these candidates who are just more of the same. And the presidential election of 2016 was a referendum on Barack Obama as well as the Clinton era. And I think that if they want to run a candidate who can appeal to people in the Rust Belt and to the typical Trump voter, they're going to have to find somebody along the lines of, say, Seth Moulton, someone who's had military service, somebody who can relate to the average worker, unionized worker in Pennsylvania or Ohio or Wisconsin. Donald Trump was able to do that. Hillary Clinton was not. I don't know that Deval Patrick, you know, with his Ivy League pedigree, is going to be able to do that. Maybe.
Okay. Also, in terms of politics here, it's also legal as well. The charges of extortion against two aides in Boston Mayor Marty Walsh's administration. There were federal prosecutors this week said in a court filing that they may have to dismiss the case against Marty Walsh's aides. The prosecutors said if the judge in the case doesn't reconsider his proposed jury instructions, then the case would be on a collision course with dismissal here. Now, these are two aides who worked for Marty Walsh who are charged with trying to pressure the organizers of the 2014 Boston Calling Festival into hiring union labor. So what do you make here of these statements that, A, the case may be dismissed, and if it is, what does this mean politically for Marty Walsh? I'd like both of you to just answer that briefly because we're running out of time. Michael?
Well, I mean, it'd certainly be good for Marty Walsh to have this thing cleared off the table, I guess. I mean, the legal question, I think this possible outcome has been kind of brewing. We've seen it in a number of other cases where sort of to sum it up succinctly, what might be to everyone's agreement unseemly is not necessarily unlawful. And I think that's what this case, just like the probation case we saw in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. the sort of federal case involving the former governor of Virginia that sort of set a sort of precedent for these things is showing that these are political issues that need to be hashed out there. If you have objection to what's going on, they may not really be, legal issues.
So I think without getting too much into the legal thicket, I think that essentially what's going on is that the law within the First Circuit isn't clear. And the government feels that they're on very strong legal footing because all of the other circuits that have decided this issue have decided that the alleged extorters don't have to have personally benefited from the extortion. Mm-hmm. The judge in this case, Judge Sorokin, essentially said that his jury instruction would instruct otherwise. Now, Judge Sorokin is an excellent judge, but I think what the prosecution is saying, not that they don't have confidence in their own case, just that they think he's wrong as a matter of law. And I think the reason Sorokin teed it up this early in the case was because I think they're all looking for guidance from the First Circuit. So they're essentially preparing it for an interlocutory appeal so that the First Circuit can weigh in and provide the legal clarity.
Mm-hmm. You can tell who's the lawyer here and
who
isn't,
about politically for Marty Walsh? I mean, obviously it's good if it gets dismissed, but has it stained him quite considerably?
Well, I don't know. I mean, he's pretty popular. So
right.
I think, as Michael said, he probably wants it to go away.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have, just about a minute here. So let's end with our hubbubs, and those are the brief stories or news events that may have caught our attention this week but may not be the headline. Jennifer, do you have a hubbub?
Well, my hubbub is out of Providence, Rhode Island, where they instituted cameras to track speeding motorists.
Mm.
And I guess they came up with 12,000 people who were violating the speeding laws. And they all got tickets for about $100, and many of them showed up to fight their tickets and complain, and the courts were overloaded.
Yeah.
But I thought it was funny because this is probably the way things are going now with technology, and also with complaints that police sort of selectively stop motorists on the basis of race or other things. This is a good, neutral way to get everybody, but
when any of those 12,000 are listening, they might not think so.
No, they might not think so, but I wonder how politicians will deal with this.
And Michael?
Mine's a little bit on a more somber note is a hubbub or a shout out really to the students at high schools in Cambridge, Somerville, a few other communities that walked out this week. Sort of to call attention for and call for changes in gun laws. And there's going to be sort of a setup for the national walkout that's going to happen next week, which will be the one-month anniversary of the shootings in Parkland. And I think one thing is that people said after the Sandy Hook shootings that if the slaughtering of six-year-olds doesn't get anyone to change, then nothing will. And in a weird way, I think what's happened is now, sadly, the victims have changed age. They're high school students, and they're old enough to sort of give voice to this themselves and take action, but maybe you could say they're young enough and idealistic enough to think they might actually be able to make something happen. So that's sort of where that's at.
All right. Can I give a really bad pun here? Because my hubbub is about something that doesn't pass the smell test. Can I say that? Okay. So Governor Baker says he's looking into why State Transportation Department's office officials in Boston spent $100,000 on a new bathroom. A private bathroom for the board member, apparently, right next to the public bathroom. And a DOT spokesperson said that they needed this private bathroom because sometimes during public meetings, reporters follow board members into the public bathroom, so they needed one of their own. So I just want to point that out to folks. $100,000 for the bathroom. Okay, Michael Jonas, Executive Director of Commonwealth Magazine, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Also, Jennifer Braceras, Conservative Political Analyst, Senior Fellow at the Independent Women's Forum, and former editor in chief of newbostonpost.com. Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.